From Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. The Pew Research Center's Jacob Poster says North Korea's nuclear ambitions have quickly become a serious concern among many Americans.
People are more worried about that than they were a couple years ago, obviously, with the provocations by the North Koreans in terms of firing missiles.
I'll talk with Jacob Poster about international polling and Americans' perceptions of threats. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss concerns about the shortage of birth control in Venezuela and the first meeting held between North and South Korea in more than 2 years.
The real impetus, perhaps, is the Olympics. Whether this will lead to a more positive relationship between the two Koreas, it is really hard to say at this point.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat. Rebecca, I'm in Rio, actually, not there in the studio with you, but I don't want to talk about Brazil this week. Rather, let's talk about Venezuela, because there's big news coming out of there this week about, of course, the continued crisis and the really significant financial problems and shortages, 800% inflation. I mean, it's just really very concerning. But one of the areas where there are shortages is in the birth control industry. They're running low on condoms, on birth control pills. So what we're seeing is a significant increase in unwanted pregnancy. At a time of crisis, of course, when there are food shortages and healthcare concerns, a lot of women are turning to sterilization as a way to prevent this from continuing. So, how do we to feel about this in terms of Venezuela's future?
Yeah, this is one of the issues that has come out of all the upheaval in Venezuela that people really aren't focusing on, but it has larger consequences. The supply of medical equipment, of pills, of other things are all very important. But one thing maybe we didn't think about was birth control pills. Now, we are seeing a situation where many are sterilizing, they're abstaining, other things are happening. But this increase that we're seeing is particularly among teenagers. And you could see where that would be an added difficulty. At the same time, we're seeing an increase in infant mortality rates. And these two things are obviously related. This past year, skyrocketing to 65% or more. That's very, very concerning. And just to give an
idea, it's even higher than Syria.
Absolutely.
We have a very significant problem with this.
Yeah, there are no hospitals. People are having their children wherever they're able to have them. There are not clean supplies. There are not medicines to give mothers and child as they're born, or they're not able to deal if there's any issue with the pregnancy or with the delivery. So lots and lots of problems there. And again, to give you an idea or to give our listeners an idea, the birth control pill supply in the last year has dropped in the pharmacies by 90%. So almost no birth control pills available. And as you mentioned, condoms and other contraception devices not available either. So there really is very little that these women, and particularly young women that we're talking about teenagers here, can do. And the consequences of this, we're going to continue to see high infant mortality, perhaps even higher. And we're going to see teenagers really affected by this. And the country's long term is going to be affected by this. A very, very difficult situation.
Yeah, long-term problems for Venezuela, for sure. I mean, I certainly understand the concern about the teenage pregnancies, but I did see that there were women who were closer through their 40s that have 7 and 8 children, and they just can't afford to have any more. They're already struggling for how to figure out how to care for the children they already have. And of course, birth rates often decline when there is a lack of hope and confidence in the future. And yet here we see perhaps the opposite because of concerns with birth control. All right, well, let's move to the Korean Peninsula, because this week, historic, if you want to say, in the sense that this is the first time this has happened in 2 years, North and South Korea have restarted their talks. They haven't met in 2 years, as I said before. The plan was to talk about North Korea's participation in the Olympics that are coming up here soon, the Winter Olympics that will be held in South Korea. The question is whether these talks are likely to expand. And of course, there's a lot of question about what's responsible for bringing these two back to the table to begin with.
Well, I think that's the thing. I don't know if we would call them historic or not, perhaps, but I think certainly unexpected. If we had looked at the news a couple of weeks ago, animosity was very high, certainly the United States, North Korea, and South Korea as well. And yet this week, the Koreas got together across the DMZ zone and are having these talks. Now, the president of South Korea has credited the United States for its role in enforcing this discussion. But it's really hard to say. As you said, the real impetus perhaps is the Olympics and the desire of North Korea to be able to showcase itself on an international stage. And the Olympics, of course, are going to be held in South Korea here in about 6 weeks. So the discussion really was around which athletes are going to go, who's going to be able to go. And they had taken the nuclear issue essentially off the table in these discussions. Still important that they came to the table and had these talks. And they did come to some agreement in terms of who would be attending, some athletes, some cheerleaders, journalists as well. And another meeting is planned to take place here towards the end of the month to solidify some of this stuff. So, yes, we should look at this perhaps as a positive, and again, that they're at the table. Whether this will lead to a more positive relationship between the two Koreas or even the United States, it is really hard to say at this point. There is still discussion about sanctions. South Korea still has been pretty adamant, as have the United States, that they are opposed to the nuclear program in North Korea and will continue to take actions against it. So, this is probably not as hopeful as perhaps we would like, but it may be an important step.
All right. Well, thanks so much for that review, Rebecca. Thanks for being here as always.
Well, thank you, and enjoy your time in Rio.
I will. Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. Or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU, and I'm at Suzette Grelot. Next, I'll talk with Jacob Poster of the Pew Research Center about international polling and American perceptions of threats. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Jacob Poster is a senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. He focuses on international survey research, and he writes about international public opinion on several topics, including international perceptions of the United States. He also conducts research on views of extremism in predominantly Muslim countries and in the West, as well as on public opinion of international threats. Jacob Poster, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here, and I'm really excited to talk about the work that you do at the Pew Research Center as a somebody working in polls and public opinion polling, global attitudes and that sort of thing. But first I want to start with just kind of this general sense that I think many of us have that Americans are kind of by and large not as interested in global affairs as they are in domestic affairs, that they would, you know, when asked, I think that they seem to prefer, seem to have more interest in or consider domestic issues to be more important to them. Is that kind of what you find? What is some of the data on that?
In general, yes. When people are asked whether they should be more interested in foreign policy or domestic policy, they tend to pick domestic policy. People are more interested in what happens in their lives, local, state, and national, than they are internationally. But when we do ask them about international affairs, when we ask them about events that happen around the world, they actually are interested. They answer our questions, and they, you know, are involved in that kind of conversation once we ask about it.
Do you think that there's a real understanding among the general population about the connections between domestic and international affairs? That you know, trade issues, obviously. Mm-hmm. So global trade is connected to one's local employment, for example.
Right.
So is there kind of a general sense that there's a positive attitude about that?
I think people understand how the world is connected nowadays, that it is more global in nature, and that things that, you know, that happen locally do affect more people around the world than had in the past. And indeed, you know, while economic issues and domestic issues tend to be on the top during campaigns and all those things, we do talk a lot about the size of our military, fighting terrorism overseas. NATO alliance was a big campaign issue last year. So it's not like these issues are off the table. People, I think, recognize them, understand them. It's just when paired against the, you know, the local economic issues, they often don't rise to the level of interest. that global affairs do.
So maybe with the exception, though, of security policy, I mean, since you just raised it, you know, terrorism and kind of issues regarding foreign policy in terms of war and conflict and those sorts of things, I think the American public has concerns about the economy and jobs and that sort of thing. But do you see that there's growing and serious concern about security policy around
typically
the world?
The two highest issues on people's minds are terrorism issues, you know, security and economic issues. They're sort, you know, they're very different, but they're also intertwined. And obviously with terrorism, there's an international component to it. You know, people, when we asked in a survey this year of Americans what they think is the greatest threat to our country, the most people chose ISIS as the top threat to the United States. And it was clearly the top threat, with other threats being cybersecurity and climate change and global economic instability. So you do see that, you know, those kinds of issues, the terrorism security issues, do rise to the top. And people do realize how that is related internationally and that international policies affect how we deal with extremism around the world.
So the fact that ISIS or cybersecurity makes it into that list doesn't really surprise me with climate change. I mean, you find in general across the population that climate change ranks in one of the top issues?
It's top three or four, depending on what type of threats or issues. Obviously, in the last year, the North Korea threat has risen in the minds of the public. People are more worried about that than they were a couple years ago, obviously, with the provocations by the North Koreans in terms of firing missiles. But climate change is fairly high, although there was a huge political divide by party. So, you know, Democrats are much more worried about climate change than are Republicans in the U.S. It would be higher if it was just one party versus the other. But as a total, you know, it's up there. It's not the top issue, but it is still an issue on the mind of some Americans.
I think that's an important point, is that obviously polling also breaks things down by demographics, right? So in terms of maybe, you know, gender, location, you know, urban, rural, party, all various kinds of things. So can you tell us about some of the results regarding in the United States before we get to this tricky subject of polling in general?
Yeah. I mean, it really does depend on, you know, what kind of question we ask. We do have one question that we asked of Americans this past year on whether we should pay less attention to problem overseas or it's best for our future to be active in world affairs. And on that question, there is definitely splits by region, by age, by party, and by education. So, you know, the college-educated Democrats and those in the Northeast are more concerned about being active in world affairs, while those in, you know, the younger people, which is sort of different, those with a high school education or less, and Republicans are more interested in paying attention to issues at home. So it really does matter about where you live, you know, your age, what your party affiliation is, that determines a lot of these, you know, responses. And that's an important part of polling, because it's not just the overall numbers, what we call the top line numbers. It's digging deeper to understand why people have the opinions they do and what makes them think the way they do.
So on this issue of polling, of course, because this, I don't know, it just seems to me that that's kind of an elephant in the room is, you know, there are a lot of skeptics out there about polls. Now, let's be fair to what you do, and that is what you do is not election polling. You're not doing exit polling. You're not doing those sorts of things. But help us understand the distinction between that kind of polling and the public opinion polling that you're doing.
Sure. Well, election polling starts with the same concept, where you take a group of people and you want to be representative of that group. So when I say Americans think this or that, it's a nationally representative group of Americans that are chosen through probability sampling telephone interviews. But when you get to election polling, you then have to determine what group of people among those general public are going to vote. And that's where the big issues come in, because the turnout of an election could be very different than the census, than what the census is telling you is the breakdown of the, you know, entire country. So that's where political polling tends to miss the most. But there are other issues in polling nowadays. We have low response rates, which means that people are less likely to pick up the phone from an unknown number. That's a big problem nowadays. It's hard sometimes to get to hard-to-reach populations that might be skeptical of people calling their homes. This includes minority groups, it includes younger Americans, and includes people who are more distrustful of government organizations or anyone who might call them. So that's also another issue where people are less likely to talk to pollsters than they were in the past. And all those things create biases that make it harder to you know, say that something is representative of the entire population. But we don't go that extra step in terms of, you know, trying to judge turnout. So we're pretty confident in our methods to get a statistically roughly a proportional sample of the countries in which we survey, including the United States. And we work pretty hard to make sure that, you know, we're methodologically sound. And we are also looking to new areas of doing polling, online polling, smartphone text polling, you know, other ways to reach people and try to answer the questions in which we're interested in.
I mean, you raised so many interesting factors that mm-hmm. affect what it is that you do in polling. And I mean, I have to admit, even when, you know, I'm in the classroom, you know, I hear from students that they're, and these are young people largely, yeah. that are skeptical of polling. They don't necessarily want to be bothered with having to answer polls. But you've mentioned all the other things, like just being able to reach people mm-hmm. Because of the cellular technology that we now have, fewer landlines, all the ways in which, you know, we now do more of our work online. So given all of that, I mean, you said you're pretty confident in how, in, you know, in your results, but it's just making your job, I would think, all the more difficult. And then when you add to it the fact that you're working around the world, you're not just polling in the United States, you're polling in 38 countries
right.
to look at global attitudes and global affairs. So how, I mean, well, you know, comparing here and there, it must be even more
it
challenging.
It is. We have actually a pretty large group at the Pew Research Center of methodologists, both international and domestic, who work on these issues, who try to make sure that we're keeping up with the standards, you know, the latest ways of doing of survey techniques to make sure that we're doing it correct. And internationally, we actually poll differently in many of the countries in which we survey. Some countries, we only call cell phones. Some countries, it's a mix of cell phones and landlines. And in a lot of countries that are developing on our country list, such as India, South Africa, Nigeria, Brazil, in places in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, we do face-to-face polling, which means that if we want to ask someone a question, we send them to a certain section of the city. They walk around in a certain grid pattern, knock on someone's door, talk to them for 45 minutes, record the results, and send it back to us. So we always have to know, you know, whether the comparability of talking to someone in their home, how that might differ from talking to someone on the phone. Obviously, you know, a phone call probably can't last past 20 minutes because people have things to do and will hang up, and that's not a good thing. While people, if you invite them in their homes, will take a little more time. So there are differences in how we do our polling, but we try to maintain a similar level of, you know, methodology across the countries so that we can have cross-national comparability, which is a very important aspect of what we do because we want to see how Americans fit into the global worldview, and we also want to see how the world sees America. And so that's an important part of what we do and what we try to bring to the general public and public advocates.
So on that note, tell us what your findings are about perceptions of the United States.
Sure. Well, in the last year, it has actually changed quite a bit. International image of the United States has dropped in many countries in which we surveyed. We think this has a lot to do with views of the U.S. president, which have also changed drastically over the past year. At the end of the Obama presidency, about 64% of people across the world, this is a median of people across the world, had confidence in the U.S. president, President Obama, and now only about 22% have confidence in President Trump. So we do see a sort of deterioration of U.S. image that is closely tied to the election of a new president. And I will say that similar ratings were found for George Bush in 2008, 2007, before at the end of his presidency as well. So that does affect how people view the U.S. around the world. It affects a lot of other issues in terms of, you know, support for U.S. policies and support for Americans overall. So there has been a big change, but overall, people still have fairly positive views of Americans, fairly positive views of American pop culture, and still say that the U.S. government respects the personal freedoms of its people. So not everything is down, but there are a lot of indicators that show that the international image of the U.S. has declined in the last year.
Well, I'd love to ask all kinds of questions about this. And just to reiterate, of course, Pew Research Center is a nonpartisan organization. You're not, I mean, because there's obviously political connotation to right. what you're finding here. But on this issue of image, I mean, from my travels around the world, and I've traveled extensively and I've lived overseas many times, is that this distinction that you just made between perceptions of or views of Americans or U.S. citizens and U.S. culture, that's an important distinction to make between that and U.S. policy or U.S. leaders and how the people that are doing things like engaging with other with our other countries, the high profile people like our presidents, mm-hmm. that's an important distinction to make. And it sounds like you're making that in your polling.
Yes, it is clear that the overall views of the U.S. tend to align with overall views of the U.S. president. I mean, people, you know, how they receive their information overseas. There's only so much you can know about another country. And it seems as though, you know, that in terms of politics, the president is the biggest figure on the stage for that and highly influences U.S. image. But on the soft power image, it's a little more diffuse. It doesn't change as much. It's not as subject to political changes. But, the, you know, events do happen and people do change their opinions based on those events, like the Iraq War is one instance of that, where George Bush was more popular before that war and then became less popular overseas afterwards. President Obama was more popular before some of the NSC information came out in Germany, for example, and where there was accusations of tapping Angela Merkel's phone, and his favorability fell in Germany after that too. So world events do influence how the rest of the world view Americans, but the election of a president seems to be one of the largest events for that kind of image.
Well, so can we just conclude with this notion? I mean, obviously you do your polling for a reason. It's obviously to inform us. It's to tell us exactly what's going on around the world so that we maybe could make better policy. What should we do with this information? What does the Pew Center do in terms of sharing this information to try and affect? I mean, should this kind of information, should this type of polling actually affect policy and the kinds of decisions that we're making?
Well, it's our hope that people take this information and use it to make sound policy decisions. We don't advocate for any particular policy decisions or advocate for any particular partisan group. We just want to put out the information that we think is most accurate of how the world thinks, how Americans think about various issues from public policy to politics to views of the internet, technology, global threats. There's a whole variety of research areas in which we do this research, both survey, public opinion survey, and also demographic research as well. And the goal is ultimately so that people are more knowledgeable about the world, that they understand better, that both American publics and world publics, you know, have a better handle on what people around the world think, so that they can, you know, especially, you know, educators, policy people who make policy, and you know, those who advise people who make policy, just sort of understand the basic facts before they try to create policy without that information. So that's the benefit we hope to provide, and we know that we can't always say everything that we want. We can't always find all the information. It's, you know, you can't, there's only so much you can do with public opinion research, but we do our best to make sure that it's accurate, that it's nonpartisan, non-advocacy, and that it's used to better society.
All right, Jacob. Well, that's a really great boost for the concept of facts, right? So thank you very much for being here today. I look forward to learning more about your polling, and as I think we all do. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Jacob Poster. He's a senior researcher for the Pew Research Center, where he focuses on international polling. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.